There was good news and bad news at the public library. Plenty of people called Jacob listed in the phone books for Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, Long Island, Westchester, the Jersey Shore, Connecticut. Reacher gave it an hour's radius from the city. People an hour away turned instinctively to the city when they need something. Farther out than that, maybe they don't. He made marks with his pencil in his notebook and counted 129 potential candidates for the anxious Mrs. Jacob. But the yellow pages showed no private investigators called Costello. Plenty of private Costellos in the white pages, but no professional listings under that name. Reacher sighed. He was disappointed, but not surprised. It would have been too good to be true to open up the book and see Costello Investigations. We specialize in finding XMPs down in the Keys. Plenty of the agencies had generic names, a lot of them competing for the head of the alphabetical listings with a capital A as their first letter. ACE, Acme, A1, AA Investigators. Others had plain geographical connotations, like Manhattan or Bronx. Some were heading up market by using the words paralegal services. One was claiming the heritage trade by calling itself gumshoe. Two were staffed only by women, working only for women. He pulled the white pages back and turned the page in his notebook and copied 15 numbers for the NYPD. Sat for a while, weighing his options. Then he walked outside, past the giant crouching lions and over to a payphone on the sidewalk. He propped his notebook on top of the phone with all the quarters he had in his pocket and started down his list of precinct houses. Each one he asked for administration. He figured he would get some grizzled old desk sergeant who would know everything worth knowing. He got the hit on his fourth call. The first three precincts were unable to help without sounding any too regretful about it. The fourth call started the same way, a ringtone, a quick transfer, a long pause, then a wheezing acknowledgement as the phone was answered deep in the bowels of some grimy file room. "I'm looking for a guy called Costello," he said. "Retired from the job and set up private, maybe on his own, maybe for somebody else. Probably about 60.
"Yeah? Who are you?"
a voice replied. Identical accent. Could have been Costello himself on the line.
"Name's Carter," Reacher said. "Like the president." "So what do you want with Costello, Mr. Carter?"
"I got something for him, but I lost his card," Reacher said. "Can't find his number in the book."
"That's because Costello ain't in the book. He only works for lawyers. He don't work for the general public."
"So you know him?"
"Know him? Of course I know him. He worked detective out of this building 15 years. Not surprising I would know him."
"You know where his office is?"
"Down in the village someplace," the voice said, and stopped.
Reacher sighed away from the phone, like pulling teeth. "You know where in the village?"
"Greenwich Avenue, if I recall."
"You got a street number?"
"No."
"Phone number?"
"No."
"You know a woman called Jacob?"
"No, should I?"
"Just a long shot," Reacher said. "She was his client."
"Never heard of her."
"Okay. Thanks for your help," Reacher said.
"Yeah,"
the voice said. Reacher hung up and walked back up the steps and inside, checked the Manhattan white pages again for a Costello on Greenwich Avenue. No listing. He put the books back on the shelf and went back out into the sun and started walking. Greenwich Avenue is a long, straight street running diagonally southeast from 14th Street and 8th to 8th Street and 6th. It is lined on both sides with pleasant, low-rise village buildings, some of them with scooped-out semi-basement floors in use as small stores and galleries. Reacher walked the northern side first and found nothing, dodged the traffic at the bottom and came back on the other side and found a small brass plaque exactly halfway up the street, fixed to the stone frame of a doorway. The plaque was a well-polished rectangle, one of a cluster, and it said, "Costello." The door was black, and it was open. Inside was a small lobby with a notice board of ridged felt and press-in white plastic letters indicating the building was subdivided into 10 small office suites. Suite 5 was marked Costello. Beyond the lobby was a glass door, locked. Reacher pressed the buzzer for 5. No reply. He used his knuckle and leaned on it, but it got him nowhere. So he pressed 6. A voice came back, distorted.
Yes?
UPS, he said. And the glass door buzzed and clicked open. It was a 3-floor building, 4 if you counted the separate basement. Suites 1, 2, and 3 were on the first floor. He went up the stairs and found suite 4 on his left, 6 on his right, and 5 right at the back of the building with its door tucked under the angle of the staircase as it wound up to the 3rd story. The door was a polished mahogany affair, and it was standing open. Not wide open, but open enough to be obvious. Reacher pushed it with his toe, and it swung on its hinges to reveal a small, quiet reception area the size of a motel room. It was decorated in a pastel color, somewhere between light gray and light blue. Thick carpet on the floor. A secretary's desk in the shape of a letter L, with a complicated telephone and a sleek computer. A filing cabinet and a sofa. There was a window with pebbled glass and another door leading straight ahead to an inner office. The reception area was empty, and it was quiet. Reacher stepped inside and closed the door behind him with his heel. The lock was latched back, like the office had been opened up for business. He padded across the carpet to the inner door, wrapped his hand in his shirt tail and turned the knob, stepped through into a second room of equal size, Costello's room. There were framed black and white photographs of younger versions of the man he had met in the Keys, standing with police commissioners and captains and local politicians Reacher did not recognize. Costello had been a thin man many years ago. The pictures showed him getting fatter as he got older, like a diet advertisement in reverse. The photographs were grouped on a wall to the right of a desk. The desk held a blotter and an old-fashioned inkwell and a telephone, and behind it was a leather chair, crushed into the shape of a heavy man. The left-hand wall held a window with more obscure glass and a line of locked cabinets. In front of the desk was a pair of client chairs, neatly arranged at a comfortable and symmetrical angle. Reacher stepped back to the outer office. There was a smell of perfume in the air. He threaded around the secretary's desk and found a woman's bag, open, neatly stowed against the vanity panel to the left of the chair. The flap was folded back, revealing a soft leather wallet and a plastic pack of tissues. He took out his pencil and used the eraser end to poke the tissues aside. Underneath them was a clutter of cosmetics and a bunch of keys and the soft aroma of expensive cologne. The computer monitor was swirling with a watery screensaver. He used the pencil to nudge the mouse. The screen crackled and cleared and revealed a half-finished letter. The cursor was blinking patiently in the middle of an uncompleted word. That morning's date sat underneath a letterhead. Reacher thought about Costello's body, sprawled out on the sidewalk next to the Key West graveyard, and he glanced between the tidy placement of the absent woman's bag, the open door, the uncompleted word, and he shivered. Then he used the pencil to exit the word processor. A window opened and asked him if he wanted to save the changes to the letter. He paused and hit no. Opened the file manager's screen and checked the directories. He was looking for an invoice. It was clear from looking around that Costello ran a neat operation, neat enough to invoice for a retainer before he went looking for Jack Reacher. But when did that search start? It must have followed a clear sequence. Mrs. Jacobs' instructions coming at the outset, nothing except a name, a vague description about his size, his army service. Costello must then have called the military's central storage facility, a carefully guarded complex in St. Louis that holds every piece of paper relating to every man and woman who has ever served in uniform. Carefully guarded in 2 ways, physically with gates and wire, and bureaucratically with a thick layer of obstruction designed to discourage frivolous access. After patient inquiries, he would have discovered the honorable discharge. Then a puzzled pause, staring at a dead end. Then the long shot with the bank account, a call to an old buddy, favors called in, strings pulled. Maybe a blurry faxed printout from Virginia, maybe a blow-by-blow narrative of credits and debits over the telephone. Then the hurried flight south. The questions up and down Duval, the two guys, the fists, the linoleum knife. A reasonably short sequence, but St. Louis and Virginia would have been major delays. Meacher's guess was getting good information out of the records office would take 3 days, maybe four, for a citizen like Costello. The Virginia bank might not have been any quicker. Favors aren't necessarily granted immediately. The timing has got to be right. Call it a total of 7 days bureaucratic fudge, separated by a day's thinking time, plus a day at the start and a day at the end. Maybe altogether 10 days since Mrs. Jacobs set the whole thing in motion. He clicked on a subdirectory labeled Invoices. The right-hand side of the screen came up with a long field of file names stacked alphabetically. He ran the cursor down the list and spooled them up from the bottom. No Jacob in the J's. Mostly they were just initials, long acronyms, maybe standing for law firm names. He checked the dates. Nothing from exactly 10 days ago, but there was one 9 days old. Maybe Costello was faster than he thought, or maybe his secretary was slower. It was labeled SGRNT-09. He clicked on it, and the hard drive chattered, and the screen came up with $1,000 retainer against a missing persons inquiry, billed to a Wall Street firm called Spencer, Gutman, Ricker, and Talbot. There was a billing address, but no phone number. He quit File Manager and entered the database, searched for SGRNT again, and came up with a page showing the same address, but this time with numbers for phone, fax, telex, and email. He leaned down and used his fingers and thumb to pull a couple of tissues from the secretary's pack, wrapped one around the telephone receiver, and opened the other flat and laid it across the keypad. Dialed the number by pressing through it. There was ringtone for a second, and then the connection was made.
"Spencer Gutman," a bright voice said. "How may we help you?"
"Mrs. Jacob, please," Meacher said busily.
"One moment,"
the voice said. There was tinny music and then a man's voice. He sounded quick but deferential, maybe an assistant.
"Mrs. Jacob, please,"
Meacher said again. The guy sounded busy and harassed.
"She's already left for Garrison. I really don't know when she'll be back in the office again, I'm afraid.
Do you have her address in Garrison?"
"Hers?"
the guy said, surprised.
"Or his?"
Reacher paused and listened to the surprise and took a chance.
"His, I mean. I seem to have lost it." "Just as well you did," the voice said back. "It was misprinted, I'm afraid. I must have redirected at least 50 people this morning."
He recited an address, apparently from memory. Garrison, New York, a town about 60 miles up the Hudson River, more or less exactly opposite West Point, where Reacher had spent 4 long years.
"I think you'll have to hurry," the guy said.
"Yes, I will," Reacher said, and hung up, confused. He closed the database and left the screen blank, took one more glance at the missing secretary's abandoned bag, and caught one more breath of her perfume as he left the room. The secretary died 5 minutes after she gave up Mrs. Jacobs' identity, which was about 5 minutes after Hobie started in on her with his hook. They were in the executive bathroom inside the office suite on the 88th floor. It was an ideal location, spacious, 16 feet square, way too big for a bathroom. Some expensive decorator had put shiny gray granite tiling over all 6 surfaces, walls and floor and ceiling. There was a big shower stall with a clear plastic curtain on a stainless steel rail. The rail was Italian, grossly overspecified for the task of holding up a clear plastic curtain. Hobie had discovered it could take the weight of an unconscious human handcuffed to it by the wrists. Time to time,
heavier people than the secretary had hung there while he asked them urgent questions or persuaded them as to the wisdom of some particular course of action. The only problem was soundproofing. He was pretty sure it was okay. It was a solid building. Each of the twin towers weighs more than 500,000 tons, plenty of steel and concrete, good thick walls, and he had no inquisitive neighbors. Most of the suites on 88 were leased by trade missions from small, obscure foreign nations, and their skeleton staffs spent most of their time up at the UN. Same situation on 87 and 89. That was why he was where he was. But Hobie was a man who never took an extra risk if he could avoid it, hence the duct tape. Before starting, he always lined up some 6-inch strips stuck temporarily to the tiling. One of them would go over the mouth. When whoever it was started nodding wildly, eyes bulging, he would tear off the strip and wait for the answer. Any screaming, he would slam the next strip on and go to work again. Normally, he got the answer he wanted after the second strip came off. Then the tiled floor allowed a simple sluicing operation. Set the shower running hard, throw a few bucketfuls of water around, get busy with a mop, and the place was safe again as fast as water drains down 88 floors and away into the sewers. Not that Hobie ever did the mopping himself. A mop needs two hands. The second young guy was doing the mopping, with his expensive pants rolled up and his socks and shoes off. Hobie was outside at his desk talking to the first young guy.
I'll get Mrs. Jacobs' address. You'll bring her to me, okay?
Sure, the guy said. What about this one? He nodded towards the bathroom door. Hobie followed his glance.
Wait until tonight, he said. Put some of her clothes back on, take her down to the boat, dump her a couple of miles out in the bay.
She's likely to wash back in, the guy said. Couple of days.
Hobie shrugged. I don't care, he said. Couple of days, she'll be all bloated up. They'll figure she fell off a motorboat. Injuries like that, they'll put it down to propeller damage.